Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Prime Minister is insisting police and politicians work together to tackle the riots that swept across England. Senior officers have been angered by criticism from some politicians about the way they dealt with the beginning of the riots. Police have stressed it was their choice to change tactics and increase officer numbers that restored calm to the streets. The Prime Minister says he was fully behind the decision.
Where I think the government and the police worked well together was through the COBRA Emergency Planning Committee. And what I think that does is it helps the police by showing that there was political backing for the changes they wanted to make and they had the political support.
A mother says she was right to report her daughter to police in connection with rioting in London. 18-year-old Chelsea Ives from Leytonstone, who's a youth ambassador for the Olympics, denies charges of burglary, violent disorder and attacking a police car. Her mum, Adrian Ives, says she did what any responsible mother would do.
I love my daughter. Any parent that loves their child should find the courage to do what we've done. It's not easy. You have to. It's our job as parents to do that.
In other news, a major search and rescue operation for a crew member missing after a tug capsized and sank on the Thames has been called off tonight. Two others were safely rescued after the tug went down off Greenwich Pier in London this morning, had been towing a barge with a crane on it. The police watchdog says it's investigating claims a Surrey police officer gave information about the Millie Dowler murder probe to the News of the World. The IPCC said it was looking into the allegations after it received a voluntary referral from the force. Now, it's been confirmed that the London Olympic Village has been sold to property developers. After the Games, a firm linked to Qatar's wealth fund planned to turn the site into homes, including affordable housing. And in cricket, Alistair Cook is now aiming for a triple century in England's third test with India at Edgbaston. A short time ago, England were 652 for six. That's the latest. I'm Jeremy Kolchik.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Bristol's favourite soul institution, the Soul Train, is back on air this Sunday on BCFM 93.2. Check us out and tune in 7pm to 9pm for the finest in soul and jazz funk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to the BCFM Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, helping us review the news this week, is Liberal Democrat councillor for Ashley, John Rogers. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, London's burning, and a couple of cars and wheelie bins in Bristol too. But why did it take police from Saturday until Tuesday evening to get the numbers out to stop the looting? Plus, the recriminations about the Stokescroft disturbances rumble on. Young man Joe Foster will be in court soon accused of making a petrol bomb. We talked to St Paul's residents Alex Hutchings and Will Stinton about what happened over Easter. Are there lessons the police and the public should have learned? And as Bristol faces two huge new nuclear power stations on our doorstep, The Sun and other papers are after Lib Dem Energy Secretary Chris Huhne, alleging he got his wife to take points on her driving licence more than a decade ago. But is the Murdoch press just after him because his doubts about new nuclear power? Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth is here to bring us up to date with government plans to make it much easier to get planning permission to build these nuclear power stations. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, possible light rain this weekend, with poor temperatures, pretty low, 15 Celsius, cloudy and blustery. Light rain on Saturday, but a fraction more sun and less rain on Sunday. Next week, temperatures down as low as 15 degrees Celsius, rain on Tuesday evening and Wednesday, sunny and cold on Thursday. Next weekend, that's the 20th and 21st of August, that's 13 and 14 degrees Celsius roughly, sunny periods and dry. And the week after next, down to below 10 Celsius, can you believe that? A bit low for August and no sign of summer yet. So anyway, that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, we've had some interesting news this week. The quarterly figures from the Bank of England, they're cutting the economic growth forecast to 1.5%, and various other things are happening. But Mervyn King was looking a little bit gloomy this week. Is this just simply... he says towards the end of this year, things will start to pick up. But wasn't he saying that about 6 months ago?
Yeah, well, the Bank of England's got a track record of being over-optimistic about the economy. And in a way, it's part of their job to talk Britain up. But that's why, if you're serious about understanding what's happening, you should always discount it when the Bank of England says things are going to improve. It's their job to say that. It doesn't mean that it will.
So what's the point in the Bank of England if all they're saying is a kind of propaganda trying to talk the markets up? Whereas we know these markets are very volatile.
Well,
and
that's why central bank governors have to be very careful what they say and when they say it. It's like, do you remember that we used to have Kremlinology, where we interpreted what the Kremlin was saying, and you had to read between the lines to get to the truth of what was happening? That's very much true of central bank governors, and it's very much true of Mervyn King today. I mean, basically, when central bank governors like him are sounding gloomy, the situation is pretty bad, because it's not their job to be gloomy. But of course, if they come out completely optimistic, they're not going to be credible. But I think the economy is probably in worse shape than Mervyn King is intimating. He's just giving a hint to people that it's actually going to be worse than anybody imagined. What he said was that there are unforeseeable and unthinkable factors may kick in. I think those are his exact words. And what he means by that is a collapse in the dollar and the collapse of the euro, which of course is quite feasible from this situation.
Why is he saying it's unthinkable? It's his job to have his head around this stuff.
Well, this is the problem. Is for many, many years, not just the Bank of England, but the whole financial services industry is based on hype. Basically, you don't sell people stocks, shares and bonds by telling them they're going to go down. So you're basically saying, hey, buy this snake oil, it's good for you. But of course, sensible people must have realised years ago, sensible people have realised years ago that the economy is in a serious, serious mess.
Well, you're talking about prices going down. We hear also today that the European Securities and Markets Authority said on Thursday that short selling combined with rumour mongering has created a strategy that was clearly abusive, and they have actually banned now short selling. Can you just explain what short selling is?
Well, short selling is where you basically bet that the market will go down. The other thing that you can do is naked short selling, where you borrow somebody else's shares to bet that the market will go down. It's getting more and more Byzantine how these financial markets work. But what's interesting is that now that the European authorities have decided to ban short selling, the market has actually perked up a bit. And that goes to show that if they adopt the right policies at government level, expansionary policies, the markets might calm down. I don't hold out much hope of that, because there's far, far too much old think in the system. People are still stuck in the era of free market fantasy land, and it'll take a while before people really wake up to the fact that it's not going to work.
One of the things that they talk about in this Reuters article here is a European assault mirrors one by the US Securities and Exchange Commission on the 19th of September 2008, 4 days after the Lehman Brothers crash. So temporarily banned short selling in 800 banks and other financial institutions. Britain imposed a similar prohibition at that time. Why do they only do this for short periods, Martin? Why is it, can they not just stop?
Because basically they should never have allowed these things to develop in the first place. Myron Scholes, who invented the Black-Scholes theorem, which is the underpinning of all of these derivative contracts which have been written in the financial markets, he himself said a few years ago that the derivatives market must be blown up or burned immediately. Now, instead of facing the reality that virtually all of the junk that's been sold over the last few years is worthless, we're still going through the motions of pretending that the private banks know what they're doing and that all we've got to do is bail them out and everything will eventually come back to normal, whatever that is. That is simply wrong. And over the next few months and weeks, it's going to become absolutely clear to everybody that the economic policy we are pursuing is unsustainable.
Well, finally, on this economics front, we've got Sir George Osborne today saying, I'll beat the forces forces of stagnation holding back the economy. George Osborne will launch a crackdown on the forces of stagnation holding back the British economy this autumn after admitting the recovery would be longer and harder than he hoped. He will throw down the gauntlet to the trade unions and other pressure groups by vowing to abolish regulations holding back business when he unveils the government's growth strategy.
Well, it's all supply-side silliness, isn't it? There's a lack of effective demand in the economy. And we've got, actually, we've got idle factories, we've got idle people, there's loads and loads of spare capacity. So the idea that getting rid of regulation is what's going to make the market suddenly magically, like the tooth fairy, appear with a sixpence in her hand, is frankly going to be shown to be absolutely stupid. Before Christmas, George Osborne will be shown to be absolutely wrong about the economy. He's been wrong all along. Serious economists like Paul Krugman and others in the States have been saying all along the policy's wrong. By Christmas, it'll be absolutely clear that it's completely wrong. And at that point, there is going to be a crisis in the government. There's a crisis in the economy already, but there's going to be a political crisis.
Now I'll also introduce John Rogers now from, he's a Lib Dem councillor from Ashley Ward. Hi, John. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good afternoon.
Hello there. And can you just give us an idea of your reaction to some of the... I mean, we have had a little bit... Well, you wouldn't call it rioting. A burning of bins, burning of cars in Bristol, particularly on Monday evening. And what's your reaction as a ward councillor for that area, the Ashley Ward, to what's happened here in Bristol?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm, like everybody else, very disappointed in what's happened. It's been absolutely horrific, some of the scenes that have come from elsewhere in the country, and it's good that in Bristol those scenes haven't been repeated, although any disorder is upsetting. It costs money, it's damaging to families, it's damaging to livelihoods, it's damaging to business, and we... You know, we haven't got the money to pay for this sort of outrage. My own feeling is that there are people who don't really think about other people. We have a generation now of, you know, with many people who are very selfish. And you know, I think I probably agree with Martin that actually that's right across the economic spectrum. So right up from, you know, greedy bankers right down to people who are disadvantaged and... you know, perhaps trying to claim benefits. So, you know, I think we all need to start thinking of each other rather than thinking just of ourselves.
Now, do you think the bankers have been thinking of each other? And this is one of the things that's been talked about, is possibly that a lot of these youngsters see the bankers looting the economy. So they think, well, let's learn to loot the shop, because essentially the bankers have got a fantastic amount of bailout money, and yet everybody in the ordinary people in the economy are having to suffer a result, and they're still getting their bonuses.
Yeah, well, I'm very disappointed they're still getting their bonuses, as I expect everybody else is. And it is frustrating. There are a lot of moves to try and push, you know, for example, there's about £10 billion pounds coming from bank levies as part of the government plans to tax the bankers. But it's difficult in a capitalist economy. You have a situation whereby, unless if the tools of capitalism aren't working, then, you know, everyone's in trouble. I think it's important that we do recognise that we do need, at the moment anyway, in the way that things operate, we need the banks, and you know, we need to get the banks lending to people who are trying to run small businesses and so on, which they haven't been doing.
So we've seen a lot of the rhetoric, the discussion about the London riots at the beginning of the week, has been around either from the Labour Party point of view, which seems to be all, you know, we're worried about the state of certain deprived parts of the community, this is what's caused it. And from the Conservative point of view, which it mostly seems to be, look, this is just rampant lawlessness and these people just need to be cut off benefits, evicted and clamped down on. So as a Lib Dem, I'd expect you to be sort of halfway in between. Which side do you come down on?
Liberal Democrats aren't halfway in between anybody. We have our own agenda of freedom and thinking.
So which side do you come down on then?
Well, I think there are certainly areas where I do support. I was asked on radio just on Wednesday whether I supported someone being arrested for having a balaclava in their pocket, you know, in a group of youths that they were trying to, you know, that looked like they were intent in trouble. And I said, yes, you know, if someone, you know, why would someone have a balaclava at this time of night on a, you know, in the middle of summer. And I think it is reasonable for the police to take robust action against that sort of thing. Having said that, I'm also aware, and in fact Stephen Williams raised it in Parliament in the debate yesterday, the fact that we do need to actually look at the role models that are in our society, and we need to think about not just the people who are rioting, but also some of the role models in our society. So, you know, he asked that question at Prime Minister's Question Time yesterday in the debate.
So can you point towards any good role models? Because a lot of people, you know, when it comes to actual decision-making in society, in lawmaking, the politicians we're supposed to look up to, many of them, are actually quite a few of them, are just coming out of jail now, having some jail sentences for fixing their accounts, aren't
well,
they?
Well, I think you're talking about
having
a very small...
hands in the till.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a very small minority of people. And, I mean, I've been a councillor now for 6 years, and there's been, all the time, there are 70 councillors on Bristol City Council. I know that there have been probably two or three bad apples during that time. And, you know, but the vast majority of all parties have actually are honourable people, and I would trust them. I know it's very popular to say, oh, I wouldn't trust a politician. But certainly, you know, I'm a politician. I'm also a GP. GPs are one of the most trustworthy of people, or regarded as that by their patients. So where do I, you know, I don't treat my residents or my colleagues or my political opponents any differently to how I treat my patients. It's exactly the same principles. So I think there are a lot of good role models. There's a lot of good role models in Bristol. Also, you know, basically all around, the fact that we try and undermine people is a tragedy. We should be basically saying, you know, people, everybody's opinion, everybody's views are worthy of respect, are worthy of consideration. I disagree fundamentally with a lot of the things that Martin says, but that doesn't mean I don't respect him. I'm perfectly happy to stand on the same platform as him and discuss things.
Okay, but getting back to this, what's happened in London, I mean, there's clearly amongst ethnic minority, particularly black communities, a breakdown in trust with the police. On Monday, we heard for the first time from a member of the family of Mark Duggan, who was shot last Thursday in Tottenham by a police firearms squad. He's Mark Duggan's elder brother. And let's have a listen to him now. His name is Sean Hall.
We're all devastated at the loss of our brother, our son, our cousin, our friends. He's got a vast amount of friends. We're all devastated to hear about the mishap. We don't actually know what has actually happened. Nobody's actually come forward and told us this is what has taken place. Whether we believe what they're saying or whether we don't, there should be somebody here putting my parents' mind at rest about what is actually going on. We don't want Mark portrayed as some kind of gangster. He's a family man, as you see from the true pictures that you'll see of him there.
What do you say to the allegation that a police officer was shot at?
I think it's rubbish. I think it's rubbish. I know my brother's not that sort of person. He's not stupid to shoot after the police. That's ridiculous. I've been listening to a lot of the news today where it seems to be the press who are generally saying that it is linked to my brother. Okay, there was some questions were supposed to have been answered. They weren't answered. Therefore, there was a domino effect from that, which we don't condone at all.
That was the brother of Mark Duggan, who was killed last week on Thursday in Tottenham, and his name is Sean Hall. Now, late on Monday night here in Bristol, there were some minor copycat disturbances. It's difficult to see why youngsters need Facebook when the presence of the police helicopter... There we are, here we have the police helicopter now. And signals to everybody trying to sleep for a couple of square miles around Stokes Croft that something is afoot.
I'm Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action Movement. Early Tuesday morning, after about 4 hours of the police helicopter above us, I thought, well, I can't possibly sleep, and I just thought I'm going to go out and have a cycle ride and see what's going on in the area. There didn't seem to be an awful lot going on. I saw one or two burnt-out cars. I saw a number of police, and I saw a number of people just hanging around. It didn't look like anything like the riots in April. And I understand from the police that it's been relatively small in this area.
So what do you think is actually behind it? And would you like to comment about what you think has actually sparked this thing off in the first place in London?
we're a society with completely wrong priorities. People are valued entirely for their wealth, just like in America. Those who have none of this feel completely alienated from society and take it out on whatever they see around them.
So what should Cameron do then to cure sick Britain?
I don't think you can expect a Tory to do very much good, I'm afraid. We need to have a complete re-evaluation of a society and base it on people, not profit. Now, this is not going to come from people whose whole raison d'etre is to keep the rich in power. I don't think he's going to do anything good at all. What's really disturbing is that sectors of the public have rallied behind a really repressive move. And are we going to repeat the experience of Northern Ireland? Are we going to go down that line?
Well, that was Ben Ritchie there from Bristol Housing Action, is talking on Stokescroft yesterday to me. John, this whole idea of, you know, that either should the government crack down on people at this point, what he's saying there is that it's actually the government is, what he's saying is profit is more important than people. Do you think that's true? And is it possible to put people above profit?
I think that's absolute rubbish. It's quite clear that people are far more important than profit, absolutely fundamentally, and that should be the case, and that should be clear from everybody's actions, all actions. The fact they're not, and the fact that there are debates, is one of those issues we need to address. But for you know, the whole idea, I mean, the description there, someone said there's not a lot going on, only two burnt out cars. Well, I mean, that's, you know, to me that is a lot going on, and that is, you know, that's horrific that sort of thing's happening. Those cars belong to somebody that, you know, they may have saved their life savings. They perhaps got third party fire and theft. Maybe they can get the money back. It, you know, these destroy and damage lives. There was mention about the police helicopter being overhead. One of the things that happened on Monday night was that actually the riots, the copycat disturbances in Bristol were nowhere near as bad as some of the ones we'd seen elsewhere. And it's because there was robust, clear, unambiguous police action. It's not acceptable for what, there's no reasons which allow people to say we can behave in that sort of way that they were behaving. So I think that people are far more important than profit, but it still gives no excuse for people to riot or behave in the way that they have been.
Martin, let's bring you in on this. You know, what are your thoughts about what Ben was saying there, and also maybe what you heard about the murder of Mark Duggan, or the killing of Mark Duggan the week before? What do you think's behind all this?
Well, I think over a generation, we haven't had a full employment economy in this country since the early 1970s. There are reasons for that, which I could go into. But the consequences are that a culture of worklessness, which then pretty easily becomes a culture of criminality. Many of these young people, for example, who are going through the courts today, once they've got this on their records, will never work. No employer will employ them. And
well, why is it that because someone hasn't got a job that they're suddenly enticed into criminality?
Well, because if you, as you will know, living on £60 a week, which is what people are expected to do, is not when they're bombarded with signals about the importance of having possessions and all the rest of it. What we've got, young men are always going to be a problem in any society. The apprentice boys in the Middle Ages used to riot in Bristol and in London, and there was as much trouble then as this lot are now. The miners from Kingswood used to march down into central Bristol and burn it down. The riots in Bristol in 1832 killed 250 people. So this is nothing new. But I'm afraid it's back to the future. We're seeing the development of, especially, just think about what the future holds for young people who left school this summer. There is probably, especially those with little or no qualifications, even those with qualifications, there are 80 people chasing every graduate level job. Now, for those with no qualifications, the chances of getting into the system are virtually zero, and they're quite rational to presume that they're not going to get a proper job. They won't. And in actual fact, they're much more likely to make a living or to make a way of life out of dealing drugs and criminality. And that's just become the norm in inner city Britain. It's been the norm in inner city Britain since the early 80s. I used to live in Brixton during the early 80s, and I saw it all then, 30 years ago, exactly the same. And I think that The difference now is that it's become absolutely ingrained, and it's going to take a lot to change it. And of course I agree that people who go around creating mayhem for others are not solving the problem, they're making it worse. And there's got to be punishment for those involved, but we've also got to ask questions about the whole direction in which we're going.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you made a comment that, you know, people who've been involved in these actions will never get a job. Well, this morning I heard on the radio of about a hotel chain that's employing two ex-offenders. They were murderers, and there was a lot of fuss about actually doing it. And the chief executive of that hotel chain was robustly defending their decision to employ those two people who had murdered, who had served their time, and they pointed out that they were amongst their best employees, and they were really good, and that particular hotel site was regarded as highest customer satisfaction. People are really grateful if they've made some mistake, and then people forgive them. And I think we should be doing a lot more forgiving and a lot more understanding.
Okay, well,
amen to that.
Let's move on to Tuesday. By Tuesday evening, police were out in force in Bristol with a mobile squad every 200 yards or so up Stokescroft, ensuring there'd be no repeat of any previous unrest. On Wednesday, Prime Minister David Cameron made a statement outside Downing Street.
There are pockets of our society that are not just broken, but frankly sick. When we see children as young as 12 and 13 looting and laughing, when we see the disgusting sight of an injured young man with people pretending to help him while they are robbing him, it is clear there are things that are badly wrong in our society.
Well, on Thursday, Parliament was recalled from recess, and the Prime Minister David Cameron gave more powers to the police.
Mr. Speaker, everyone watching these horrific actions will be struck by how they were organised via social media. Free flow of information can be used for good, but it can also be used for ill. So we are working with the police, the intelligence services and industry to look at whether it would be right to stop people communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder and criminality. I've also asked the police if they need any other new powers. Specifically on face masks, currently they can only ask for these to be removed in a specific geographical location and for a limited time. So I can announce today that we are going to give the police the discretion to require the removal of face coverings under any circumstances where there is reasonable suspicion that they are related to criminal activity.
Yeah. And the Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, asked if this was the right time to reorganise the police and get rid of the police authority along the lines of the US-style police commissioners.
Given that we've had a year of social unrest, from the student protest to direct action against the cuts to the looting over the last few days, and of course there were riots in Bristol a couple of months ago, all of which puts pressure on our police forces, can I urge him to listen to the voice of the chair of my local police authority, who wrote to me over tonight to say the last thing the police authority needs at the moment is the disruption and the distraction caused by going for elections for police commissioners?
Well, of course police authorities don't welcome the fact they're being replaced, but I think it's right they're being replaced, because I don't think they've done a good job at calling police chiefs and police forces to account. And I think we do need a new system for doing just that.
And today, Labour's leader Ed Miliband insisted that there needs to be a proper look at the causes of the riots. Is it a culture of greed learned from the bankers and politicians? Are police killing people with impunity? Or is it just students having to pay up to £50,000 to get a degree? Or lack of jobs?
I strongly urge the Prime Minister to, without delay, set up that commission of inquiry we need. And it's got to go through all our major cities, the major cities that were affected and the major cities that weren't. And I have to say this, if he doesn't set up that national conversation, I'm going to do it myself. Because we cannot allow a situation to develop whereby there is a focus for a few days on these issues and then we go back to business as usual. It is our duty as politicians, my duty as leader of the opposition, to make that happen. That's what I'm committed to doing.
Okay, now John Rogers, Ashley, councillor, Liberal Democrats. Can you just tell us whether you think that David Cameron's response is a good one? I mean, he's your LibCon leader. Do you think he's responded the right way to this, doing things like responding to the, stopping people having balaclavas, also possibly intervening on these social networking websites?
Well, I have to say I'm no fan of David Cameron. He might be a parliamentary colleague of a coalition government that's been introduced to try and sort out the the mess and the legacy that was left over by the last government. However, in terms of as being a local Liberal Democrat, I do recognise that there is need to support the police in the actions they need to take. I don't actually see that plastic bullets or water cannons or bringing in the army are actually going to help in the situation we find ourselves in Bristol. What we need is to have we need to have good community dialogue. We need to identify those people who are engaged in this thing. My impression in Bristol is it's actually there are a number of gangs around in Eastern, Lawrence Hill, in St Paul's, who are active, and I think it's gang members, possibly not only within Bristol but from outside Bristol, who are the focal points of these things, and they turn from fighting amongst themselves, and we've seen some tragic stabbings and things in different occasions in Bristol. They suddenly find that they think they can run amok and cause damage and mayhem across the city. They attack small businesses and large businesses alike. It's appalling. So I don't see that we need to introduce lots of new powers. I do feel that people who are wearing balaclavas in the middle of summer, I can only assume they're doing that to disguise their identity. And frankly, they should be stopped and they should be arrested on suspicion of causing an affray or conspiracy to cause an affray. And frankly, people who are hanging around in large groups when there is such a tense and difficult situation, they need to be at home.
It's probably not the case here in Bristol, but certainly if you talk to people in Tottenham, there's a complete breakdown of trust in the police. And this whole business of the killing of Mark Duggan last Thursday is just almost, clearly the spark for the riots, because the looting was taking place in Tottenham in the same area that evening, and the police didn't really seem to have much of a presence in Tottenham. And this sent a message around the country that suddenly it was a bit of a free-for-all with looting. So how do you address this mistrust in London anyway with the police? The people just simply, they can't phone the police when they feel they need to phone the police because they don't trust them.
I think that the Metropolitan Police has got rather a lot to address in issues, particularly their relationship with the press, their relationship with politicians, the way that there's all sorts of things, all the News of the World scandal and so on. I think that they do have to earn the trust of people. I have to say that in Bristol, even Somerset Police, we've had some good inspectors, we've had good teams there. Really, I mean, going back to the troubles in St Paul's in the 1980s, we have really active local PCSOs, local beat officers. They come to every meeting. They're always available. They're always available at the end of the phone. I'm astonished. I send emails to some of those police, our local beat police, about problems I get in Ashley Ward, and I get replies within an hour, just to an email, which is routine. And so we have a system which I've used on quite a number of occasions, of a 24-hour non-emergency phone number, which is 0845 456 7000. You can phone that any hour of the day or night. I've always found I would get answered within 30 seconds, even though it's not an emergency number, and they will take your details of anything that you've seen or observed, and they'll get back to you. So I think we've got a good relationship in Bristol with the police, and it sounds like the Metropolitan Police need to get their act together.
Martin.
Well, I would second that. I think we do have a pretty good relationship with the police, although in the second hour we're going to be talking about what happened over Easter. A lot of the police misbehaviour was by squads from out of town, as we've identified. I think that society is made up of rights and responsibilities, and that includes the general public and the police. When we're talking about punishment, of course, I mean, in the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s, 3,500 top executives in the United States were sent to prison. We've seen hardly anything happen on that front, either here or in the United States, and that does breed cynicism. And I'd also point out that in the United States this weekend, probably hundreds of people will die in gun-related violence, and that is normal in the leading capitalist society on the planet. We're just not even halfway there.
So what about this issue that Kerry was raising about the police authority? Because they're now looking to change the oversight of policing from a committee made up of councillors and lay members to one single individual police commissioner. And this is something which I believe the Lib Dems, John, are actually rather stamping their feet
about. We're pretty unhappy about that particular aspect of the coalition policy, and have made that very clear all along. And certainly all the Liberal Democrats in Bristol, we agree with our Labour colleagues on that one. It is something that is part of the coalition deal, and I guess we will go along with it.
But why? This is the question. I mean, surely if you've got one individual who's elected by the people in the city to actually oversee the police, then that's actually a lot simpler and more efficient.
Well, it's also the recipe for disaster. If you've just got one person, you need...
If
you've got the wrong person. Well, it's even the right person. It's quite difficult. I think the beauty of this current system is actually you've got a number of local councillors, both from right across Avon and Somerset area, right the way down to Yeovil and up to Gloucester, who all get together, who actually scrutinise the police activities. They can report on it. They report back to full councils across the area. If you have one person... it's going to be a hell of a lot on one shoulder. So I personally think that this idea of elected police commissioner is a poor one.
Well, they say that the police authority is quite distant and people don't know it exists. Well, they meet up in Portishead on the top of a mountain in a kind of fortress thing, which is the Avon and Somerset Police Headquarters. Maybe if they held their meetings in Bristol City Centre, maybe more people would go, more people would know about it. But Martin, what about this whole idea of a commission? Can Ed Miliband really hold his own commission of inquiry into the
causes
of the riot?
What he's saying there is that the government should organise an inquiry. I remember.
Well,
they don't do it, he will. But the first demand is to call an inquiry. I remember the Scarman report coming out after the Brixton riots, and actually it made a big difference to policing both in Brixton and elsewhere. I think the police have changed out of all recognition from the early 80s, and I'm absolutely honest. I had dealings with the police in Brixton in the early 80s, and they were totally unprofessional on many occasions, and they've changed their attitude enormously. What police officers know, good police officers know, is that they need the consent and the trust of the people they police, not the comfortable people who just call them up when they're burgled, but the people they deal with every day, who are basically the excluded, the downtrodden, the marginalised. And they've got to have an understanding and a sympathy for the people they deal with, rather than a punitive attitude. And good police officers know how to get those people on side. We all know who are the real troublemakers in the community. If we want to identify rioters, for example, Bristol's the kind of city where we can identify who they are and they can be dealt with, because everybody knows everybody. And that's the way to do it, not bashing people over the head with a helmet on.
Going back to the causes, though, Martin, I haven't really heard your take on this yet, this killing of Mark Duggan last Thursday. First of all, we were told that he'd shot first. Then it comes out that actually, no, it was the police that shot first. And also, they're using these shaped charge dum-dum rounds, which is supposed to be illegal under the Geneva Convention.
I think what caused particular anger was the statement that there was a bullet in a police radio which he had shot at them, and it transpired that was a police bullet. Now, frankly, incidents like that need to be properly and independently investigated. That's why we have a procedure for investigating them.
But they have this Metropolitan Police themselves have said... The IPCC are investigating it.
Yes, and the Metropolitan Police themselves have said that we didn't get in contact with the family quickly enough to explain to them what was happening. And if we had done that, then perhaps there wouldn't have been the protest.
Well, there was no need for them to get in contact with the family, because the family plus loads of friends were actually waiting outside the police station until nearly midnight.
I know, but all I'm saying to you, Tony, is that an event of that kind needs to be properly, thoroughly investigated, because of the fears that may arise. And the real danger, as we saw in Northern Ireland, I mean, one of your correspondents there mentioned the Northern Ireland situation. For 30 years, nationalists and Catholics were absolutely alienated from the police. Hundreds of police officers were killed by the IRA. And any Catholic that had anything to do with the police, and the real IRA are still killing police officers, especially Catholic police officers. But there's been a complete change of attitude there, and that just shows what's feasible and possible when there is political dialogue. Now, the problem we've got with these rather ill-educated, semi-criminal, alienated young people is that there is no mechanism for dialogue with them. And I was reading earlier in The Guardian by Hugo Young, I think it was, saying we must talk Was it Hugo Young?
Hugo Young died.
No,
about
it
10
must
years
be somebody
ago.
Else. It doesn't matter. But the point is that one of the things we need to do is actually talk to those who've been involved, especially those who've been arrested, and find out what actually happened. Because I actually think in lots of cases there've been different. It's been different in different cities.
Do you mean
it?
Hug a hoodie?
I mean understand what happened. Because what really annoys me about events like this is everybody immediately gets on their soapbox and comes up with their pet theory about what happened, and we still haven't got the facts yet.
I think that's absolutely correct. That it's really important that people are kept informed, even if it's to say we can't make a statement yet because we're still investigating it. I think the IPCC have now, the Independent Police Complaints Authority, have literally today issued an apology because they contributed to that incorrect information, and so I think it behoves us all to check it out. I think there was an MP who was twittering about what was happening on St Paul's down in Stokes Croft right on the first day of the first riots, saying there's an eviction going on, aren't the council stupid for evicting someone on a Thursday night? And actually it wasn't an eviction, but
it was a conspiracy.
Having people repeating rumours, there's a very nice there's two things which have happened on social media in the last couple of days. One is that there's a new hashtag, so people are putting hash unverified. So if they're passing on information which they don't know themselves, they haven't seen with their own eyes, they're putting hash unverified, which I think is a good idea. There's also a chap called Leon who's cycling around Bristol and actually looking at the sites where he's hearing about Twitters, and he and his friends are twittering as a user called Bristol Riots, and is actually giving accurate information about what's going on around the city. Now, it's good that he's doing it. It would be even better if the police started doing it.
OK, now moving on to another story. A record overcrowding on our trains. Up 60% of peak services are standing room only. This is in the Daily Mail. Services into Paddington in the morning peak had a crowding figure as high as 18.5%, while the First Great Western Train Company had the highest levels of overcrowding across the morning and evening peaks for London. So not very good news for anyone who has to go up and down to London, does it, in the rush hours. Rail Minister Theresa Villiers said these figures clearly demonstrate the importance of our plans to tackle overcrowding on our railways. We are now embarked on one of the biggest programmes of rail capacity improvement for 100 years, including more than 2,700 new rail carriages and £900 million programme to electrify rail lines and Crossrail and Thames Link in London. What's your thoughts about this, John? I know you used to have the transport portfolio. It seems there's not a lot of not a lot of reasons to get on the train if you're going to be not even be able to get a seat and you're going to be stuck in like a sardine. They've never been more overcrowded, our trains.
No, I mean it's great that more and more people are travelling by train, but obviously it's trying to encourage people to travel off peak and travel at times which are less busy. Our capacity on our rail is inadequate. There's been very little investment in it since Beeching closed a lot of these lines down. So it's good that there is investment coming along, the electrification, the improving the lines between Bristol and London and out to Cardiff and so on. But it is a measure of the success. I mean, the local railway line, I came here this afternoon on the Severn Beach line. That's now got half hourly service, and it's busy.
I was thinking maybe there'd only be about three people on it in the late afternoon coming into town.
Exactly, late afternoon. There was, I guess, probably 60 or 70 people on that train. When we first doubled the service on the line, we invested £450,000 a year subsidy. We're now only investing £200,000 a year subsidy, and that's to allow them going late into the night when it is quiet and all during the day when it's also quiet. But the rail investment is a very worthwhile area to invest.
Well, it sounds like it's desperately needed.
It is. It's well overdue.
I think that's right. I mean, one of the problems was identified by Andrew Marr on this when he was looking at his overview of Britain on television a few months ago, and he pointed out that the Stephenson gauge for the railways is too narrow. And if they'd listened to Brunel and had a 5-foot rail gauge, we could have much bigger carriages because everything, in fact, is geared through this 19th century rail gauge, and this is what you this is what you call path dependency. It's like the QWERTY keyboard on computers.
So how was it that in the years gone by we didn't have anywhere near so much overcrowding?
Because what we've got, don't forget that the overcrowding is only on the intercity lines.
Even when people hardly had cars.
No, on the intercity lines, this is where the money is made. The real expense of running a railway system is all the Seven Beach lines and so on, and all of the commuter lines coming into London. Now, in actual fact, you cannot run a public transport system at a private profit or any kind of profit. You have to subsidise it, which is why privatising the buses and the railways was an act of stupidity in the 1980s, and then we had a 13-year Labour government which did nothing about it. I remember John Prescott going on about an integrated transport policy. Do you remember all of that? There was going to be an integrated transport policy, and then the road lobby nobbled him and nothing happened. What we do in this country is we put up with second, third-rate rubbish. In Norway, in places like that, Oslo, they don't have a privatised bus and rail system. It's been run by the state for donkey's years, and it runs like clockwork. We basically put up in this country with rubbish, and we get used to putting up with rubbish. And
also,
and that's why we get rubbish.
Also, First Great Western have the honour of having the second most crowded train in Britain as well, which is the 6:45 Paddington PM Paddington to Reading service. Can we see any end in sight, Martin, though, to
well,
this?
I mean, I think what's interesting...
It's not realistic. No, it's is it to denationalise?
No, no,
no. To renationalise them?
Well, yes, it is, especially when they're losing money. I mean, what happened with Railtrack? It had to be renationalised, because that's the only thing you can do when things start to lose money. Now, to break the back of the recession depression that's coming, we will need massive public investment, and railways and public infrastructure of that kind are obvious targets
for such
investment.
Sorry to disappoint you, but there's no money for it, Mark.
Oh, yes, there is. There's plenty of wealthy people in this country who've done very well out of the last 30 years of deregulated financial markets. They started off as millionaires, they are now billionaires. The banks are still paying bonuses and shareholders, even though they are technically bust and in fact should be wound up, and many of the people running those banks are criminals and should be in prison, and all of their assets should be confiscated. Just as looters must pay the price for being in the wrong, so must the people at the top, and we need to see some of the people at the top being sent to proper prisons. I mean, Peter Galbraith in the US, he's a top economist, he's saying what we need to see is top bankers sent to proper prisons, but what happens when they cheat is they get fined, and that is not a deterrent for people with the kind of money they've got. They need to be sent to proper prisons where they will share cells with looters, and at that point they will realise that they've been breaking the law.
And then we can afford to renationalise the railway.
Yes, we can, because we'll take the money off them. We will take the money off them. Ultimately, this is not going to be about printing money. The government at the moment is talking about turning the printing press on. That's not the way to do it. There are plenty of people with money in this country, and they've done very well out of looting the national treasury, including, for example, the privatised railway shareholders who've been bailed out.
What's your position on this? Do you think that actually we should see some of these people at the top going behind bars from the city?
If someone is doing criminal activity, then yes, I totally agree. I'm not the same view as Martin.
But most of the time, this is actually virtually deregulated, hasn't it? So what they're doing isn't necessarily criminal.
It was deregulated. Sorry, Martin. Can I? Yeah. One of the things that we did see a lot of deregulation. In fact, it was one of the things that Gordon Brown was most proud of, the fact that he was actually deregulating all these things. And I mean, Martin was talking earlier about this selling short and all these financial instruments, which actually are sort of stepping away. They're basically into the realm of just talking money rather than talking about investment, buying things, selling things. I actually agree with Martin that we should be investing in infrastructure. We ought to be investing in buildings and support. We need to get the building industry. One of the things I'm trying to get is encouraging investment in Bristol into something called extra care housing, which is basically housing for older people, which is designed so that they don't need to go into a nursing home or a care home, because it's actually beautifully laid out. It's all designed so that, you know, there's plenty of room to move around, walk-in showers, walk-in toilets, all those sort of things, or, you know, and we've got 600 of those units. We could do with another 600, and we've got a number of sites around the city which would be ideal. So, and we've also got a lot of people who've got property. I think it's something like two-thirds of people now over the age of 65 have equity in their homes. So if we can release some of that equity in their homes to build and develop things, that would be really good. So I'm actually very keen to see some of these investments. I'm very happy with the investment in rail. It's a major investment in rail, and it's long overdue.
Now, it's all very well to say you want to see investment, but where is this money going to come from your point of view, John?
Well, I have no problem in borrowing money if that is for a clear purpose such as that. We can't just say we're going to borrow money to pay off our debt, which is what was happening before. But if we're borrowing money as prudential borrowing to do something, to actually get people working, get businesses rolling, get activity happening, then I'm perfectly happy. We are borrowing money, and we like to borrow more money even as a council, but certainly as a government. But what I don't want to see is this constant borrowing money basically to pay our interest payments on the money we've already borrowed. That is unsustainable, and all we're doing is passing those problems on to our children. So what we have to do is by all means borrow money to do good capital stuff, you know, to actually build required infrastructure and so on. But it's not right to do it just to pay off our interest payments.
The trouble is, we're actually not spending more, we're spending less, aren't we? And one of the other things we're spending less on is buses. Epolitics.com tells us that bus service cuts threatening the most vulnerable. That's the website where I found this one. Councils are best placed to ensure more competition amongst bus operators. Bus passengers are facing above inflation fare rises and the loss of services because of spending cuts. Vulnerable passengers have been hit hard by the changes, which have left the English bus industry facing its greatest financial challenge for a generation, according to the House of Commons Transport Committee. The report warns £300 million worth of funding cutbacks have meant rural evening and weekend services are heavily hit, with thousands unable to get to doctors and visit sick relatives. So where's our investment in buses? It's all being pulled out, isn't it?
I mean, the investment in bus services. I mean, one of the things that's happened in Bristol is that because we've got a virtual monopoly with First Bus, who have set their own prices for the subsidised services. So it's literally very expensive to run an evening or a weekend service or bank holiday services, and there was a tendering process. What's ended up happening is that the council has said, look, we can't afford those prices, we're having to make the savings that we're making. And now what's happened is actually First have come along and said, well, actually we can provide them at a commercial rate. And you think, well, that's interesting, you can now do that.
So why couldn't you before?
Well, exactly. And I think there are all sorts of questions in the way that we commission those services. So although we've had a lot of adverse publicity from cutting some of the subsidies, the end result is that the reduction in bus services in Bristol is actually not that great.
It's terrible if an elderly person can no longer actually get to the doctor at all.
Well, I mean, you don't normally get to the doctor on a Sunday night or a bank holiday.
They're talking about cutbacks in rural services. I mean, some services have gone completely.
Well, we're not a rural area. Bristol is very much a central area. It's a city area, and there aren't the same level of cutbacks. It is a major problem in rural areas, and one of the things that when I was involved in the transport arrangements was that we were trying to marry up the requirements of a city with the requirements of the rural areas around the city. So, you know, some of the transport needs for Bishopston, Lawrence Hill, Hartcliffe are very different to the transport requirements for Thornbury and Winterbourne and areas outside. They have different requirements, and we have to and it's actually, whereas it's quite easy to run a cost-effective bus service within the city, it is very difficult to run one in rural areas.
So, Martin, we've just done trains, now it's buses. I mean, really, the answer is to get a car, isn't it?
No, I think the problem is that we've basically got a taxi.
Maybe.
We've got a dog's breakfast of a transport system as a result of ideological choices that were made in the 1980s. We've basically saddled ourselves with a privatised system where we have to tweak like mad to get the kind of results that John's talking about from First Bus. If Bristol City Council or Avon and Somerset were running the bus services, as would have been the case in Oslo, for example, or Stockholm or Bologna or any other well-managed European country, we wouldn't be having this silly conversation. But we're having this silly conversation because 30 years ago we decided to get free market fever, and we're still getting over it. And we're not over it yet, because we're still talking about second, third-rate options, when we could, of course, have a first-rate option. Now, the crisis itself will give us the opportunity to say what we really do want. I was glad to hear what you were saying about better provision for elderly people and homes. We need a list of things to do, and we need to go and do them. But this government isn't going to be the one to do it.
On to our next story. And a US helicopter was shot down last Sunday during a combat mission in Afghanistan. Officials say the Chinook was assisting an Army Ranger unit when it was hit, killing 30 Americans and 8 Afghans. It makes it the deadliest single loss for US forces in the decade-long war in Afghanistan. The Rangers, Special Operations Forces who work regularly with the Navy SEALs, afterwards secured the crash site in Tangi Joy Zarin area of Wardak province, 60 miles southwest of Kabul. Elsewhere in Afghanistan, NATO said insurgents killed 4 Alliance service members in 2 separate attacks in the east and the south. It didn't provide their nationalities or other details. These deaths bring to 369 the number of coalition troops killed this year so far in Afghanistan, and 46 this month. Now, this isn't looking very good, John, is it? This is the worst single attack so far we've had in Afghanistan. Do you think it's time to give up and come home?
Well, I think the coalition government has already announced its intention to withdraw from Afghanistan. I saw a film about the original army of the Taliban, which happened when as a secret war in America in the 1990s, where they actually put large amounts of money and into arming the Taliban to get rid of the Russians. And the final scene was the senator who'd put all the work in, Senator Wilson, who'd put so much work into doing this. He'd managed to get £1 billion a year to support those rebels and get rid of the Russians. But as soon as the Russians were gone, he tried to get £1 million to get education and schooling in for all those people there, and he completely failed. So it was a really poignant film, starring Tom Hanks as that senator, and it was just we are good at going to war. We're not so good at planning for the peace afterwards.
Is it just a sort of political football, though? Because it's an important place strategically, isn't it? Right in the middle of Asia, Afghanistan. And I wonder if you know, you really go along with all the reasons that we're there. We're there supposedly to stop terrorist training camps and all these terrorists which are apparently being trained up and sent to Britain. Do you think that's the reason, a good enough reason to be there?
Well, I must admit, I doubt that the risks from terrorism are nearly as great as is meant. We have far more people dying on our roads than we have in terrorist activities, and from heart disease through lack of exercise and smoking than ever terrorism causes, and yet we have these huge costs. I think a lot of it is actually related to the drug trade and its work. One of the things that we're actually doing in Bristol is we're going to have an inquiry day later on in the year to look at the actual cost of the prohibition of drugs and what that approach has in terms of both locally to the local economy and the health services and so on, but also internationally.
Well, that's a story we covered last week, that the Lib Dems are looking at potentially decriminalising drugs. Is that something you're in favour of?
I'm certainly in favour.
Why, though? Why?
Well, because I think at the moment you can supply drugs by prescription. A doctor can prescribe them. You can dispense them in a chemist. You can sell them in licensed premises. This is alcohol and other drugs. Or you can supply them through drug dealers. And we choose in Bristol to ensure that all drugs which are not prescribed, not dispensed, all illegal drugs are supplied through drug dealers. So we have gangs, we have criminal activity associated with it, we have poor quality, we don't tax it, we've got all those sort of costs associated with it. Because prohibition, which they tried in the 1930s with alcohol, it just, you know, it doesn't work. Criminal activity will then be led. So I think it's worth exploring. I don't know what the answer is. I'm not sort of someone who thinks that we should be selling lots of drugs in Asda or whatever, but I think we should actually have an open and honest debate about what the cost is of the current policies.
Okay, Martin, what's your reaction to this attack in Afghanistan, first of all?
Well, the stuff I've been reading, I mean, don't forget that these Navy SEALs that have died, many of them are the ones that were supposedly involved in the Abbottabad incident, as I call it, when Osama bin Laden was supposedly stiffed and put in concrete boots and thrown in the sea. And many people in Afghanistan and Pakistan are asking serious questions about why they're saying, have the Americans killed off this SEAL group? Because they know more than they ought to about what actually happened in that incident.
Crikey, that really is a
You say, oh gosh, that sounds conspiratorial.
Well, no, but it's,
that is the way people in Afghanistan and Pakistan think. Whatever we think, that's the way they think.
I know certainly the Americans initially claimed that they'd killed whoever it was that fired the rocket launcher at this Chinook.
I mean, the Taliban have said no, the guy's still alive.
And the Taliban of yesterday said that he's still alive. So there's lots of rumours about
deception is very much a part of war. Petraeus himself, who's been the general in charge in Afghanistan, said it's all about managing
deception. In fact, initially last Sunday, NATO said that they might have had engine trouble and crashed.
Well, basically, we're being told a lot of fairy stories by everybody, aren't we? And what really happened, who knows? I think I'd just like to pick up on Charlie Wilson's War. People should watch that film because it really just shows the root of everything that's happened. We armed and trained the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. MI6 were the lead agency. That's why we have lots of Muslim extremists in Britain, because MI6 brought them all here. That's what happened. That's what Melanie Phillips and others need to realise. The drugs trade, very important. Wali Karzai was assassinated not long ago, the brother of Karzai. He's the top drug dealer in Afghanistan, according to the DEA. He's on the CIA payroll. He's our ally. That's what the boys are protecting. That's okay. The reality.
Okay, so I take it that you don't think we should be there in Afghanistan.
Well, we should never have gone in the first place, because there are all sorts of questions about all of these things.
Thank you, Martin. We're coming up now to time for the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Liberal Democrat Councillor for Ashley, John Rogers. After the news, new nuclear power stations and also London's Birmingham and a couple of cars and wheelie bins in Bristol too.